Hello and welcome to Learning Welsh, a series of podcasts on the Planet website focusing on experiences of learning Welsh. Each time we'll be bringing in two guests with similar backgrounds and then finding out all about their motivations for learning the language and their thoughts on the process. David Preece is your host.
So welcome to this new range of podcasts that Planet are putting on. We'll be looking at the experiences of different people from different backgrounds of learning the Welsh language. Today my guests are Mike Parker. Thank you for coming in, Mike.
Hello there, David.
And John Barney. Thank you, John, for coming in.
Hi.
Do you want to give Mike a quick description of your background and your relationship with the Welsh language?
Well, I've been living in this part of the world in Mid Wales for 15 years now. I did go to a Welsh class before I was before I actually moved here. I was writing The Rough Guide to Wales when I was living in Birmingham, and I did go to a Welsh class there in Birmingham for a while at a language centre they had, which is a lovely lady from Bala trying to teach a load of Brummies. Early Aitha Nevoeth. But since I came here, I've done the intensive course a few times at Aberystwyth University, and that's been my main route into the language and using it as well.
John, how about yourself?
Well, growing up in Abergavenny on the southeast border in the 1950s, there was no Welsh and you were hardly aware of the language. I remember occasionally on a Sunday twiddling the dials on the radio and you'd pick up a chapel service and him singing. But it might have been 1,000 miles away as far as one was concerned living in Abergavenny.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I moved to Denmark in 1969, where I lived for 13 years, that and learnt Danish, that I suddenly began to think about the ways in which the language you speak actually changes how you perceive the world. And some days I would speak nothing but Danish for several days at a time if we were visiting my wife's relations. Mm. And it's in Denmark, paradoxically, that I therefore began to learn Welsh from Karada's little and rather mistitled book, Welsh Made Easy.
Very good.
There is no such thing.
So give us an idea then, John, about how much of the language you heard when you were growing up, if at all.
As I say, virtually only what I sometimes picked up on the radio on a Sunday when I was bored and tuned into the BBC Welsh Home Service. Yeah. There was a bard in Abergavenny, John Owen Aveni. Mm-hmm. Who my mother spoke of in awe as being a poet, mm-hmm. but I never met him or never knew anything about him. So, yeah, the answer is basically nil.
And, Mike, I know that you occasionally holidayed in Wales. Was that your first contact with the language?
Yeah, it was. I mean, through things like the signage and all that kind of... I mean, that was big in the 70s. I was growing up in the 70s. And, you know, no, it wasn't just seeing the names on the signs, it was seeing the painted out signs mm-hmm. and things like that. And you think, oh, what's the story there then? Mm-hmm. And of course, that was the time of the first wave of language protests, really. People daubing the signs. And then hearing it. I mean, I grew up only 30-odd miles the other side of the border in North Worcestershire and knew nothing about this distinct, different, discreet culture going on just under my nose, really. We were taught nothing of it at school and no one spoke of it around. So, you know, it was kind of invisible for everybody, I think, to some extent.
So what happened then with you two? How do we find ourselves X amount of years later and both of you have picked up the language and you seem to have developed a unique relationship with it? What happened with you, Mike? What drove you to go, right, yeah, go on in, I'll have this language?
Well, what drove me was the interest in Wales. I was writing about Wales in things like The Rough Guide and what have you, and various journalistic exploits. And seeing that increasingly so, really, that the language was an integral part of that. And to understand Wales, to get to know Wales, I could only ever do it to a certain extent without some of the language under my belt. That was the motivation, really. But it really went up a gear when I moved here in the spring of 2000, and then it was I was in Mid Wales, in a Welsh-speaking area. That was imperative, really, that I do it. So that's when I signed up for the first intensive course and did a month long of, you know, all day, every day.
Mm. So the springboard was your
just being here and being and wanting to to, well, they say croesi'r bont, don't they? To cross the bridge into the kind of different, because it is, as John was saying, I mean, it's not about learning verb endings and mutations and all that. Well, that's the thing that gives you the grief in the actual learning of it, but it is about that being a key to a culture and a history and a literature and a way of thinking, which is different.
So you said you're in some intensive courses at the moment. How's that? How's that coming along? How do you? Is it successful?
Yeah, I don't know really. I mean, I've just been back into the intensive summer Welsh course in Aberystwyth 13 years after I'd last attended it, and I went back because I wanted to kind of brush my Welsh up to a better standard, and it felt like the right time to do it. So I've just done a couple of weeks of that, and it was hard work. It was hard work being in a classroom for a couple of weeks and seeing. Yeah, just having that bit of your brain, because languages really do. I mean, without a doubt, they there's one part of your brain that is only hit by languages, and you can feel it being sort of flabby and hopeless, and you can feel it being pummeled as well. It's like going to the gym, isn't it? And that bit of your brain starts to hurt as if you pulled it or something. And you know, and I think for native English speakers, there is some people who've got English as a first language. There is part of the English language culture, and this is the same in Britain, in America, in Australia, and other English-speaking countries around the world, that does encourage a kind of monolingual laziness. And that's quite a kind of cultural thing you have to fight against to get to grips with another language.
John, what was your process of picking up the language?
Well, similar to Mike's in this, or my motivation was similar. Having lived in Denmark and learning Danish, I realised that language changes your perceptions, as I said. And so I began learning from Karada, and I began reading people like Kate Roberts, DJ Williams, Gwen Alt, T.H. Paddy Williams, and so on, under the conviction that these writers were going to give me an insight into Wales, a perspective on Wales, which was very different from the one I had growing up in such an anglicised part as I did. And that was very important to me. It even changed my attitude to writers like R.S. Thomas, and Dylan Thomas, for example, who I had read for a long time.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So you got to a stage where you were able to read those texts.
Yeah.
And then is that an aspect of your academic background at the time influencing how you thought you would pick up some Welsh culture through the language?
No, it's purely a question of the fact that I learnt it in Copenhagen, where I don't know that there were any other Welsh learners or Welsh speakers. And so I did it in total isolation. So what I got up was basically reading knowledge, and it wasn't until I came to work for Planet in 1985 that my spoken ability increased in that, you know, as you know yourself from working with Planet, we deal with Welsh speakers all the time, our printers, authors, and so on, so that it became an imperative, really, to try to get up the language orally sufficiently to handle these kinds of occasions, these kinds of people.
I do find it fascinating, Joe, though, that it was when you went to Denmark that that really intrigues me, that it was there that you thought, right, this is the time to get to grips with Welsh, just because we, you know, it is so much thought of as, you know, yr aelwyd, the hearth, the home, the something that's quite sort of small, not small, but something that's very sort of inner. And there you are going all that way to come back to something inner, which might well be something that, you know, a hiraeth that was kicking in perhaps for you in Denmark. But I mean, just looking at the course I've been on this last couple of weeks here in Aberystwyth, I mean, there were people in my class. I mean, one class I was in for a week, I was the only person in the class that lived in Britain, let alone Wales. You know, there were people in there from America, from Australia, from the Netherlands, from Germany, Romania, Palestine. You know, it was just this incredible United Nations of people all gathered to learn Welsh.
And yeah, I think that's one of the extraordinary developments of the last, 20 years, really. When you get a Welsh society in Tokyo with young Japanese people learning Welsh, that would be inconceivable when I started, and probably when you started learning. So there's a kind of, you know, a diaspora of learners, which is a very hopeful development for the language, I think.
Yeah, apparently there was a textbook published in Tokyo in Japan 3 years ago, 2011, Learn Welsh Through Japanese, and it sold something like 35,000 copies in 3 years.
Amazing.
That's not bad, is it?
There's an inordinate amount of interest. I have yet to get to the bottom of why that is. Hopefully we will get one of these learners in and we'll have an idea of why it's so relatively popular. But to bring it from the international back down to the national then, John, you essentially found your wish to speak Welsh when you left the country. What were your feelings towards Welsh when you were based in Britain before you moved to Denmark?
I don't think I thought about it. I lived in Birmingham for 8 years where I was a student and a year in Nottingham. And I don't think I thought about my identity other than the 5 square miles around Abergavenny. That was reality for me and everything I was and felt I wanted to be was related to that landscape, that small town. And I didn't think beyond that. If I went into the valleys or if I went to Carmarthen to visit my old schoolteacher, Wyn Binding, who now taught there, I felt I was moving into areas of Wales where I wasn't exactly comfortable. But I wasn't comfortable in Birmingham either. That in a way, I felt an outsider everywhere except in my little home patch. And it was only going to Denmark and coming up against a small country, 5 million people, but with a vibrant language, a vibrant literary culture, that I began to perceive that my little patch was part of Wales, but it was only one small part of it, and I wanted to explore Wales in greater depth. And in order to do that, I felt you had to learn, no matter how inadequately, you had to learn the language.
So you taught yourself, essentially.
Yeah.
Was that a factor in your decision to move back from Copenhagen?
I think it was in the end, yeah. I'd been there for 13 years and I could have stayed until I retired. But related to this is the fact that I started writing poetry in about 1975, 76. And I felt a growing imbalance between the demands of an academic life and that demands I felt as a writer, and I knew I, in a way, had to give one up or the other, so I gave up the academic world and returned to Wales. So that plus the feeling that Wales was where I really wanted to be were the two main decisions there, yeah.
It's fascinating because one of the reasons why I asked you both to come in is because I realised you were both border people. Mike, does that spark any ideas in your mind when you were, you know, growing up, noticing this other culture and then your relationship with it now? Is there a sense of a growing relationship, or is it something that you felt that was just quite practical?
Well, it's both, really. I mean, it's practical and it's a sort of romantic and philosophical and literary and all the rest of it. I mean, in terms of change, changing relationship. I mean, I remember reading Trevor Fishlock, one of his books about Wales, and him saying that he hasn't learnt the language for the reason that he wants to keep a kind of journalistic distance from the country of which he is, you know, which he's reporting and he's writing about. And that was a way of doing it. And I find that a slightly odd argument, I must say. You know, it's I don't think you'd apply the same thing if you became a Spanish correspondent. You know, you're going, I'm not going to go to Spain and I'm not going to learn a word of Spanish because it'll help me keep a distance from, you know, well, yes, it'll keep a distance from everything, wouldn't it, including what the hell's going on.
Yeah, well, quite.
And I don't think it's any different in Wales, really. And I suspect that I just felt like I needed to cross the bridge, you know, to cross the bond and to try and, out of a practical sense, my sort of relationship with the language is not a very romantic one. I sometimes wish it was more romantic. It is a practical means to an end. It's a language I want to learn the language, not because I want to give speeches in it or I particularly want to write in it. I've tried writing in it and I'm really not very good at it. What I want to be able to do is to sit in my local pub and have a conversation with people without them having to change to accommodate me. And it's that prosaic, really. As well as be able to watch telly and listen to the radio and read stuff. That's all part and parcel of it as well. But it's, you know, it's a kind of growing identity and it's one that keeps changing. And I get really frustrated with it sometimes as well. I mean, I get frustrated with the sort of chippiness of a lot of Welsh language culture and, you know, and how sort of thin-skinned it can be about things.
Yeah.
And that, I understand it. I understand why people feel like that and understand why it happens. But I feel it's kind of counterproductive. But, you know, it's there for better or for worse. I'm part of it, and I'm very, very happy to be so.
We kind of touched on it a second ago. The process itself is fascinating, I think. I grew up bilingually, so I have no idea of what it is to learn Welsh. How difficult is it? I'll give that to you, Mike, first.
Okay. Well, people always say it's very difficult, and I keep meeting people who say, and their excuse is, it's too difficult, I can't. And that's just not true. Of course, the danger is that, or the problem is that like you and I, David, I mean, we've known each other for years. We've spoken a little bit of Welsh together, but not very much, because we started a friendship in English, and that's the way it's continued. And it's quite hard to change
the
language of any relationship once you've kind of set it in stone. Same in Welsh, actually. But in terms of the actual mechanics of it, it depends what kind of person. You know, everybody works differently. I mean, I first started off on the Ulpan course here in Aberystwyth, which I thought was very good. It's very immersive. You are sort of dunked down almost to drowning point. And you kind of arrive, you surface spluttering, but you're spluttering in some kind of Welsh, you know. So that's kind of quite a good course. I found now, going back after more than a decade in the last few weeks, slightly alarming is that 10 years ago, Welsh seemed to be remarkably and happily free of that kind of tedious management speak that we've got so used to in English in the last 20 years or so. And going back there this week, it seems sadly to have crept into Welsh too. You can be just as anodyne, bland and annoying in Welsh as you can in English, which is not progress, I'm afraid.
Yeah, what are we talking about? Posters on the walls?
Stuff in the handbook as well. You know, obviously just lifted off the net, you know, some bad translation of some kind of awful mission statement in management speak Welsh. You know, I don't want to read that in any language.
Well, I guess it's the commodification of the process of learning Welsh. People have heard that it's a burgeoning language, and I suppose certain companies might want a piece of that pie. Yes.
Well, you could say it's a positive sign in that Welsh is keeping up with the trends that are there in the major languages, even those trends are awful. Welsh is in there with it.
Yes, I suppose so.
No, yeah, if you know, you got to take the rough with the smooth if you're dragging something with you, kicking and screaming. That's a good point, actually.
Could I go back to the point you asked Mike about, is Welsh a difficult language to learn?
Yeah.
Because I think Mike is right that, you know, all languages are at a certain level equally difficult. I think one reason why Welsh seems perhaps more difficult to English speakers is because it's a Celtic language and its grammatical structures are in many ways quite different from, you know, a lot of English people will have a smattering of French, perhaps a smattering of German or Spanish. And if you're learning a Germanic or a French language, it is, you feel you're within certain grammatical bounds which are familiar. But when you come to Welsh or Irish, there are grammatical structures which are totally unlike anything you've come across before. But I think once you overcome that barrier and you internalise such things, then it's no more difficult than French or German.
And in some ways, I'd say, this is my answer to people when they say, oh, I can't do it, and I can't even pronounce, you know, I look at a sign and it just, all those vowels, just, oh, dear, oh, no, it's all the consonants, isn't it? The language with no vowels, by having seven of them, is that actually, it's a hell of a lot more regular than if you learn the alphabet in Welsh, there are exceptions, but there aren't many exceptions. It's always, you know, you will be able to pronounce stuff, which
Welsh
you could never say about English, could you?
No, Welsh is a very phonetic, it's language. Welsh spelling is very phonetic. It's much easier the pronunciation than, say, Danish.
Yeah.
It is a visual language, isn't it? If you have the alphabet, you'll be able to enunciate each word according to what you see, which in many ways ought to be quite helpful. But to go back to the point, and it being a difficult language or not, is what you're saying is it's relatively irrelevant then, because to a certain extent all languages are difficult.
Yeah,
I think to be honest, that is trotted out so often as a kind of maxim, and in truth, it's really a bit of an excuse for people not bothering, not sticking at it, and just turning away. And I think that is part of the, I'm afraid to say, the sort of global monolingual arrogance of a lot of English speakers.
Yeah, because the English speakers, a lot of them, don't understand. You know, you hear it said so many times, not just in Wales, oh, they all speak English. And if you go to Denmark, it's true, though not so true in rural areas. And you can get by if you're a tourist. You can order in a cafe in English, etc., etc. But if you really want to get into Danish culture, that is not enough. You're always going to be way on the outside unless you have an insight or an entrance into the language. And that's true anywhere in the world, it seems to me. English is a kind of lingua franca, but it's not more than that, and it doesn't give you the entry to another culture that a lot of people mistakenly think it does.
I mean, I remember meeting a guy years ago at a party who'd lived in this area for 15 years, at least. It was nearly 20 years, I think. And I was with a mate of mine who was a bit bolshy and had a couple of drinks, and she said to him, we were talking about the Welsh language, and he was going, oh, I'm just not going to, you know, it's too hard, it's too difficult. And she said, well, can you count to 10 in Welsh? He went, no, I can't. He was from Scotland, in fact, not English. And she said, well, can you count to 3 in Welsh? Said, no, I can't. And that amazed me, because that's to not be able to say the words "Un, dau, tri" after more than 15 years of living in this part of the world. That isn't just a kind of passive indifference. That's an active, resistance. I am not going to engage with this on any way, shape or form. You know, and that's something a bit more sinister than just, I can't be bothered.
Well, I find this fascinating. The point is we're kind of encroaching on the idea of tunnelling into culture via language. Obviously, the primary language of Wales is English. If you're going to learn a language first and you were coming here, it probably would be English. But then the idea is, of course, what I'm hearing, I think, is that both of you wanted to dig deeper, cross your bont, you said, to cross the bridge. Is that why you want your cup to run over with culture, for you to be able to connect further? And if so, does that mean if you don't learn the language, that you will never fully grasp the culture of a country? I'm not specific about Wales, but that's what I think that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
Is this true, John? I
think it is true, yeah. And another reason why I have wanted to learn the language, like Mike, is that, you know, in Comins Coch, where I live, just outside Aberystwyth, there are a lot of Welsh speakers, and I speak to them, almost all of them, in Welsh. And it gives you a different entree into the village. And we have some English friends there who've lived there for 30 years, as we have, haven't learned a word. And the whole aspects of the village are simply invisible to them. You know, there's an invisible world, an invisible life going on there, which they never have access to. It. I mean, it doesn't seem to bother them, but it would bother me.
Yeah, I'd echo that, absolutely. I mean, I think, of course, you can do that. You can absolutely live in Wales. You could live in the middle of Caernarfon, the most Welsh-speaking place in the country.
That would be hard.
You would struggle, actually, in Caernarfon. You would struggle.
I've done that, mate.
Yes. Yeah, that can shut a covey. No, you know, and plenty of people do. It is perfectly possible to live here without Welsh, whether it's desirable or not. I just don't know. And even on a friendship level, and I look at, I mean, my partner's a first language Welsh speaker. Lots of my mates are first language Welsh speakers. I see how different they are in their mother tongue, in their mamiaeth. You know, I mean, we all have languages are keys to parts of ourselves as much as they are keys to culture and all the rest of it. And different, you know, it is very true to say, if you want to learn French, a good way of doing it is to sort of adopt that slightly kind of shoulder shrugging, you know, that'll help you sort of sound a bit more French. If you want to sound a bit more Welsh and get more into it, you have to sort of try and sound as if you're about to impart the biggest, best piece of gossip you've ever, ever heard. And that's part of, you know, that is part of the kind of culture, and it's a wonderful sort of part of it. And I think it's such a shame that people put the shutters up and don't want to know, because it does all go on around them, and as John says, it's invisible to them, and that just seems a pity, because that means there are barriers where really they don't need to be.
No, yeah.
Just one example, our neighbour who died a few years ago, an old spinster who had been a librarian, a school librarian, and she'd been a big friend of Waldo Williams.
Oh, right.
And we often talked about her experience of Waldo. But to these English people who were also neighbours, she was just a little old lady. They had no idea that she was this highly cultured, extremely well-read individual. She was just this little old lady living in a bungalow.
I would love to have known Waldo myself. Mm. I'm quite jealous now. Mm. No, it's true. It's about perception and visibility, isn't it? Mm. And engagement, which is even more important from my point of view. Sorry to throw myself in here into this interesting discussion, but I can't imagine going to another country and not learning as much as I possibly could and to engage with them in their own culture. It seems bizarre and a little bit odd to me. But that's probably because of my own personal background.
I think that's right, because I think a lot of English people simply wouldn't, it wouldn't occur to them this, there might be this option in a sense.
And I think my point on that is actually a lot of people who speak Welsh and who campaign most passionately for it and on its behalf and love it more and more, you know, more than anybody else on the planet sort of thing, they have to take some responsibility for this as well in a way. Because if people move to rural Wales, say, or come here on holiday, and all they've ever heard about the language is that it's on its deathbed, there's hardly any speakers left, because that's the picture that is so often painted by campaigners for the language as much as those against it, then you can hardly blame them when they fail to engage very much with the language, because they just, all they've ever heard about it is that it's dying. Yeah. And it's so far from that. It's so far from that. It's so deeply rooted. It's so widespread. We need to get away from the deathbed scenario thing, because that is doing nobody any good, at least of all the language.
I think regarding that nature, I think there's too much of a relationship between the campaigners and policy at a governmental level. I think my personal take on this is that the idea is that we find individuals who really would like to engage and just let it happen naturally, slowly, however you want to do it, a really quick and intensive drowning course like yours, Mike. I can't quite imagine it. I'd love to be a fly
call it
in
that,
the wall.
Actually, yes.
The drowning course.
Course body.
Course body.
Not waving, you know, not drowning, but waving, obviously. Yeah.
Anyway, the idea is, of course, is that we've got two gentlemen here in the office today who had barely little to no relationship with the language. And now, of course, you've got an incredibly strong bond for very different reasons, of course. That process is fascinating. So hopefully we'll be getting some more pairings in the future. We'll be looking at people coming in, talking about their relationships. This is the podcast series we'll be pushing now a little bit. It's going to be fascinating. So please join us again. But I'd like to thank my guests for coming, and diolch yn fawr iawn, John.
Croeso.
And Mike, diolch yn fawr iawn, thank you.
Croeso, diolch.
I know you're a busy man, so it's great to see you both here. As I just said, we'll be doing a series of podcasts on people's processes, relationships with learning Welsh, seeing what they've got to say from all sorts of different backgrounds. Today we have two border gentlemen, and you heard what they had to say. It was very, very interesting stuff. So remember to bookmark this page, remember to subscribe where you can, and come back to the website. We'll have some more for you. Diolch yn fawr iawn, a pob hwyl.